Yes, good morning everybody. Our first paper is paper 12, which is the IFRIC update from November. There were just a few items I wanted to highlight from the November meeting for you. The first one is top of page 2 to do with the interaction of IFRS 9 and IAS 28. Just wanted to highlight that because it was an important paper that was discussed by the Interpretations Committee, but you do have a paper coming this morning that Takashi will be discussing, so I won't go into any of the detail in this summary. I then wanted to move on to a couple of the tentative agenda decisions that the Interpretations Committee published in November. The first of these is the top of page 4, and it's to do with the guidance that we have on derecognition of modified financial assets under IFRS 9 and IAS 39. Now, this is something that we've spoken to some of you before on this topic, and this was the Interpretations Committee then having a follow-up discussion on this. We've received a number of requests, or a few requests over the last few years for guidance on derecognition of financial assets when they've been modified or exchanged. The committee's looked at some detailed particular questions over the last few years, Greek government bonds being one of those. But out of that, there were some questions that came, or a question that came about whether there could be some additional sort of generic guidance on derecognition developed. The committee looked at this, considered the history of the board's work in this area, but really concluded that this was too broad of an area for it to take onto its agenda, and felt that the guidance that we've got at the moment really is should be sufficient for people to identify how to address those sorts of issues that the committee has looked at in the past, so consequently decided not to add anything to its agenda for this topic. The second item I wanted to highlight was at the bottom of page 4, and it's to do with the variable payments for asset purchases, particularly property, plant and equipment and intangible assets. And this is an issue that the Interpretations Committee has discussed on a number of occasions over a number of years, and had put on hold pending the progress on the leases project, which of course has now been completed. Now, this issue is about when an entity purchases an item, an asset, and there is some contingent payment to be made in the future that is going to vary according to particular future events, then when should it recognize a liability for those future payments? How should it measure that liability? And the Interpretations Committee, having discussed this again and having considered developments in the board's work on the conceptual framework exposure draft, and also the board's work on leases, felt that it wasn't able to reach a decision. It had mixed views, in particular whether there should be a liability recognized on day one for future payments where the amount of the future payment is dependent on actions of the entity itself. And so was it something that was within the control of the entity and therefore shouldn't be recognized a liability, or whether irrespective of that there should be a liability recognized and measured on the balance sheet. So ultimately it considered that it was too broad of an issue for it to deal with, and has published a tentative agenda decision which is out for comment, and it will look at the comments it receives on this in its March meeting. Linked with this, it has also been looking at a similar issue relating to variable payments in the context of a service concession. It looked at that in parallel because it saw sort of similarities with this particular issue. It did discuss it a little bit further to see whether they could reach some agreement on the recognition of and measurement of a liability for a variable payment in a service concession. on the basis that perhaps it could be seen, a service concession could be seen as being perhaps more like a lease arrangement and different or distinct from a separate asset purchase. But ultimately, the committee's views were mixed on that and concluded that it couldn't reach agreement. So it will be in due course publishing an agenda decision, a tentative agenda decision to that effect. Those were the issues that I wanted to highlight from the paper. Yes,
Weigo. Highlight to us the last issue. The only area you're not linked to is the revenue standards. Why? Because the purchase from purchaser side, either side is the seller side.
Yes.
Why not discuss from that point of view?
And there is the guidance there in the revenue standard for the purchaser. For the seller. But I think the Interpretations Committee was focusing at least initially on whether or not there is a liability there. And there were mixed views on that. Some felt that there was a liability, but others felt that there wasn't a liability because of, we're talking specifically here about it being within the control of the entity. And therefore they felt that was distinctive and leading to their conclusions on this.
I understand the recognition aspect, but you refer to lease standards, is a lessor-lessee sequence relationship. But here it is purchase and the sales transactions. It looks like a much more, the logically linked together,
Yes, you raise a fair point, but the committee felt that there wasn't automatic symmetry between the purchaser and the seller in these sorts of transactions.
Of course, so symmetrical or not is debatable, but totally ignore the edit decision in the revenue standards looks like for me not. So appropriate.
Mary?
Michael, the two issues that you highlighted relating to variable payments, contingent payments, I guess I'm struggling with the conclusion by the Interpretation Committee that it's too broad. And maybe there's a distinction between it's too broad and the Interpretation Committee thinks it's unlikely to be able to reach a consensus, because to me it's a clear interpretive question of existing standards. We have a model that says if it's BizCom, here's what you do with contingent payments. And this is an issue, these are issues that are being answered every day in practice. So I think it sounds like we have potentially significant divergence in practice. It isn't clear to me from this. And I can also see these variable payment agreements having a very significant effect on the balance sheet of entities that, let's say, buy an agreement and the sales price is dependent upon future sales, generated, et cetera. Those payments can be quite large in some industries. So I think it is important to look at the feedback that comes back, not just about the wording of the, agenda decision, but how significant an issue is this? I don't think it's so much broad as maybe concern about ability to reach consensus. And if they think they can't, what is their recommendation about what should be done? Because I don't like having an issue. I'm less concerned about the service concession, which is a single specific industry versus something that I think might cut quite broadly. And so I'd like to keep this on our radar screen of not, it's too hard, make it go away, because I don't think it is going to go away.
No, and it is a practice issue, and you're right, people do need to make a judgment in practice in order to account for these things. And maybe too broad is the language that we've used in the agenda decision, but to some extent it's the conceptual question. Is there a liability or not when it's in the control of the purchaser? that's fundamentally where the sticking point was. And some committee members felt, yes, there is, and others, but it's a question of measurement, and others felt, no, there isn't. Mm-hmm.
I don't want to lose sight of it, because I think that this is a big practice issue. And if they don't solve it, then I think we have to think about whether we solve it and what, you know, and what's involved.
Sure.
Adding to what Michael said, I think a lot of it did come down to differences of views, lack of consensus, and also the sense that they got as far as they could sort of reading the words and standards and hadn't been able to reach a consensus, and it was really getting to the next level of conceptual discussion, which they felt was maybe beyond the scope of what they'd been asked to do. Mm-hmm. I think most people around the table in the end, and correct me if you disagree, Michael, but I think most agreed that if you accepted it was a financial liability, which most did, that 32 would probably tell you did have a liability. People then questioned whether or not they liked that answer, I think, was where the conceptual started to come up. And there were lots of questions about when it would be appropriate to sort of create a linkage between the asset and the liability in some way, like we had on leasing. But I think they felt that wasn't necessarily a call they could make within the context of the existing standards. So maybe it's partly does it need to get elevated to us, and the feedback that they get on the draft agenda decision maybe helps us with that.
Yeah, because the linkage issue even goes back to IFRIC 1 and the question of, as you adjust variable payments, do you adjust the carrying value? But the you don't get any sense from this, so it doesn't help practice at all of the statement that you made of most people think it is a financial liability.
If
which
you accept it should go in the scope of that, yes.
Yeah. And that may be.
But I do flag they didn't necessarily all think that was a good thing.
Yeah.
Peter. Two comments. First of all, there's a distinction made here between business combinations and outside a business combination.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me the question of whether there is a liability has to be the same for both. I mean, you might come to different recognition conclusions, but it can't be a liability in one case and not in the other. The other thing is, I think it's worth thinking about the asset side as well and what you have, because there might be two ways of thinking about it. One is you've acquired a single asset and have got a liability to pay for everything for acquiring that asset. Or a second view could be that you've acquired a bundle of rights initially, and then there's an option to acquire some additional rights. And if you view that as an option, you're more likely to say there isn't a liability there, and you'd account for that that usage option separately and account for that when you exercise the option, and that's partly a unit of account question as well. So it might be worth thinking about, if we pursue this any further, it might be worth thinking about the asset side as well as the liability side.
I understand the difficulty of the interpretations committee. We as a board give somewhat of a contradictory guidance based depending which standards you look at. Business combinations, yes, there is a liability, financial liability. Leases, there is no liability, although it would be a financial liability according to our standards. Revenue recognition, if it is a license based on royalties, the seller has no revenue until the licensee realizes this future activity which is under its control, so it has no receivable. And you could question, why would the licensee have a payable in that case? And we say probably no, because if the licensor has no receivable, it is unlikely that the licensee would recognize a liability, which would be a financial liability also. So the fact that it is a financial liability doesn't help much, because sometimes we say there is one, sometimes we say there is none. So I think as interpretations committee members don't know really to which standard they should link their interpretation, because we are just in conflict.
Yeah, but we do need to distinguish if a liability is not recognised, whether it's because we think there isn't a liability and we're not recognising there isn't a liability, or there is a liability and we're not recognising.
As a board, we don't know.
And I know we're not always clear in the standards either on that point.
I think as a board, we are not quite sure. I mean, it depends which situation, which kind of asset. It is strange, because depending on the type of asset, there is a liability or not. Hmm.
I think in the lease standards, we decide have liability. The reason why not recognize is because of measurement uncertainty. And in terms of loyalty, the exception, you know, this issue covers not only intangibles, but also cover the, you know, physical aspects.
Well, the basis for the leases document says there were different views, right? So
exactly.
we're talking about where, for example, it's an amount depending on use. Just to be clear, we're not talking all lease liabilities, but where it's based on turnover or something. I think the basis says some people made a sort of cost-benefit cut and some people questioned whether there was a liability. So to Philippe's point, there were different camps.
That's right.
Okay.
Okay. Then
lease.
Okay. The purpose of Agenda Paper 12A is to explain the due process steps that the ISB has taken finalizing our scope amendment to IFRS 2 on the classification and measurement of share-based payment transactions and ask the ISB to confirm that it is satisfied that it has complied with the due process requirements. So we would like to ask you the questions in page 10 of this paper. So the first question is, do the ISB members agree that the amendments to IFRS 2 should be finalized without re-exposure? Do you agree?
We do.
Okay. Do any ISB members intend to dissent from the final amendments?
That's not the case.
Do ISB members agree with the 1st of January 2018 as a mandatory effective date for the final amendments with earlier application permitted?
We agree.
Are ISB members satisfied that all the due process steps required to date that relate to the publication of the final amendments have been complied with?
Yeah,
we are. All right.
April.
Thank you. Agenda paper 12B. This paper summarizes the feedback that was received in response to the exposure draft classification of liabilities. In the ED, we proposed clarifications to the guidance in IS 1 presentation of financial statements relating to the classification of liabilities as either current or non-current. In the paper, we recommend that you finalize the proposals, and we also recommend the next steps that we think should be taken to address some of the points that were raised in the consultation. The paper contains an analysis of the respondents in paragraph 10. We received 88 comment letters. The paper goes on to analyze the responses by question in the request reviews, and I think we'll ask you for comments question by question as we go through the paper. So question one, which begins on page 5, concerns the proposal that classification should be based on rights at the reporting date. Most respondents agreed with replacing discretion with right in paragraph 73 of the standard, and most agreed, for the reasons given, that it should be rights at the end of the reporting period that should affect classification. We did receive mixed views about the proposal to remove unconditional from paragraph 69. Some respondents asked for more guidance about the nature of the rights at the end of the reporting period, whether they were substantive or enforceable, and in particular, some asked how conditions that were only applied and tested after the end of the reporting period should be assessed. Respondents also discussed the effect of lenders' rights on classification and questioned whether a lender's right to immediate payment, repayment, should result in a liability being classified as current. Respondents referred to the ISB's decision that classification be based on compliance with covenants at the end of the reporting period and not with management expectations about events after the reporting period. The staff summarized this in paragraph 41 of the paper and suggests some further types of transactions that were raised in the comment letters that should be considered by the ISB in a future date to test the proposals. In paragraphs 42 to 45, the mixed classification model that's currently used in IS 1 is discussed, and also why the staff do not propose revising the mixed classification approach currently used. Have you got any questions on the responses to question 1 and the request reviews?
Sure.
Thanks, April. I agree with not looking sort of fundamentally at what the underlying objective is in IS 1. But some of the questions that have come up, which I think are good questions, do sort of beg the question of what it is we're shooting for in IS 1. So if I look at the example, which I think is good actually in paragraph 41, this idea of testing I think is helpful because it makes it more real. But I think we've got a sort of, When I'm looking at those questions, it would help me if the staff have done an analysis of what the objectives are, in the sense of, is it that we're trying to get a handle on what the flexibility of the entity is? So, for example, that would mean that if I've got the ability to keep something running more than 12 months, but only if I meet certain covenants after the reporting date, that may not be within my control. So, you know, in a worst case type of scenario, I might not have the flexibility. That might be an interesting way to think about things. Or am I trying to get at what I expect to happen? So the fact that management has got a long-term facility but has got the right and intends to repay in the next 12 months, am I more interested in understanding that? Or is it the fact that legally I can't be kicked out? So again, I go back to the legal restrictions. And for me, when I'm looking at what I think we were trying to achieve, it would help me, when the staff does the analysis, to understand what the logic is that we're applying to get to our answers, because unless we've got at least that foundation, I'm not sure if we're going to be consistent in where we draw the line. And I think it will help us be more clear if we've got a better idea of what it is that's driving our decisions. And I think the list you've got in paragraph 41 will be helpful. So it's not as far as going and sort of questioning the whole philosophy in IAS 1, but at least trying to have a parameter for understanding properly what the philosophy is that's meant to be applied.
Following along the lines that Sue just was discussing, the key messages that you outline here in paragraph 13, some of them I think should be obvious from the discussion that we've had in the ED, but some obviously want more clarity. I think it would be useful to be very clear and answer some of these questions. And you can tell me, April, whether or not you think the language is in there, or whether or not you're actually, if I've missed something, you're proposing to address this. But in particular, this one about in 13A, the right to defer settlement includes uneconomic terms that would cause management to avoid exercising those rights. So essentially, it's a non-substantive right. So if we were to put language in there to say that the right has to be substantive, i.e., you know, and then address that as an example, I think that would be very helpful. The lender has a right to repayment on demand. Again, that would essentially counter whether or not, you know, the right is substantive. So whether or not we put them as examples or you know, how we address them, I think it would be very, very critical, because there's no imagination, end to the imagination, I should say, to the counsel for the lender here, right? So they may be very sanguine when saying, you know, we'll go along with whatever the accountants or the standard setters want here, but then back here in this paragraph we'll have these provisions that effectively override or negate. It's kind of like the existing situation where it says unconditional, but you know, back at the end of the document they have all these conditions, when in fact it's not unconditional. So I think it's important that if we're going to change the wording here, that we address these points in paragraph 13. Otherwise, I actually think that accountants will just look at one paragraph, they'll hone in and say, does it say they have the rights, check the box, when in fact they need to read the entire document to see if those rights are overridden, they're not substantive.
Doc.
Thank you. I just want to make a clarification about the meaning of removing unconditional. I already had a word with April privately, and somehow I understood, but I just would like April to elaborate what's the meaning of paragraph 35. I'm confused with the paragraph 35. Paragraph 35 talks about the question from the Hong Kong, and this is talking about the repayment on demand. And in your wording, you concluded, actually, we reinforce what the Hong Kong is doing. And in the first place, I couldn't really understand. And the reason why I didn't understand is, in many cases, a loan agreement has a kind of what we call MAC clause, material adverse clause. And it is quite often. And then there are a variety of MAC clause. And the, some of the MAC clause is totally same as the kind of repayment on demand clauses, because the judgment of materiality totally up to the lender, if the lender is more powerful than the borrower. So then I'm confused with the meaning of removing the unconditional in the context of the paragraph 35 you explained. Could you elaborate?
The interpretation that was raised in Hong Kong deals with a situation where you've got a term loan, but the lender has a right to repayment on demand. And I think looking at IS1, the conclusion of that would be that the borrower might have a right to defer payment, to defer settlement for more than 12 months. But that right is actually overwritten by the right of the lender to require repayment on demand. Mm. And so you would conclude that the borrower doesn't, in effect, have a right to defer settlement for 12 months because the lender's right is to immediate repayment on demand. I think that's slightly different from the case that you were thinking of, which was the material adverse clause case, because there you do have a right to defer payment, although it is subject to a covenant that you won't have any material adverse events happening to you. And I think in accordance with the proposals, you would look at whether or not you're in compliance with those covenants as at the reporting date. Mm. And if you are in compliance as at the reporting date, you would then say that yes, you do have the right to defer settlement and you would classify it as non-current. Because when we discussed this, when the board discussed this some time ago, they thought that they wouldn't take into account expectations about future, management's expectations about what might happen in the future. So I think in the case of a material adverse clause, you would actually say that you did have a right to defer it because you were in compliance at that date with the covenant.
But my concern is the judgment of materiality is totally up to the lender. And if the economic situation is getting worse, then you can the borrower can make their own judgment. But there is no guarantee that judgment is correct.
And I think what this hinges on is not the removal of unconditional, but the board's discussion that they thought that events after the reporting date shouldn't be anticipated and you shouldn't take expectations into account. Mm. And so you know that as at the reporting date, the bank doesn't think that there's been a material event because they haven't actually triggered the MAC clause.
Mm-hmm.
So you know that you're in compliance at that stage. And I think the board's advice is not to speculate about what the bank might do in the future.
Gary?
Thank you. And, I'm whether looking at paragraph 13 or paragraph 41, it's sort of the same question, just a few observations. And by the way, I really do agree, field testing, these are good questions and they exist in practice. Yeah, just a few observations, for perhaps put into your outreach questioning. I think if I'm looking at paragraph 41C, I think covenants only required to be tested after year end. I think that's common. And by the way, if you've got interim reporting, either semi-annual or quarterly, the chances are it's still only an annual test. So I think this is a form of management's estimate, I think. And sometimes you only have to test the covenant until after you file your statements. It might be 120 days after period end or something. So I think you should approach it. How do preparers or lenders think of this in terms of being an estimate? As of the reporting date as opposed to a detailed calculation. I think the last discussion hit on when you've got conflicting rights, either the lender's rights or the borrower's rights. I mean, how does in practice do they resolve, which one is senior to the other in all cases, and how does that get resolved? I would look into that. I think in paragraph 41D, when management basically has the right largely to do anything they want, pay it now, pay it later, assuming the lender doesn't have, a veto power on it. I think he got asked the question, well, at December 31st, gee, my intention is not to pay it. Come February 1st, before you issue statements, my mind has changed. Well, that's a subsequent event. And how does that factor into it? I think it'd be, because ultimately you're only, I think it's probably a management representation letter in terms of audit evidence. What are you thinking? But if you do change your mind before you publish your statements, I think it's almost impossible to ignore, you know, where management intention comes. And then you open up rights in place and existence at the reporting date. Now I've opened it up into a subsequent period. And that, I think, begats the question, what do you do if you cure a violation during a subsequent period, which is not where we are. But if you open up where management's got a right in one direction, I think it's hard to ignore. What if you fix it going the other way?
Mary?
I think helpful summary of the feedback, just a couple of thoughts for further work that's done to progress it. One is, when I look at, for example, the discussion in paragraph 28, it seems to be economic compulsion rearing its head in a different context than we usually find it. And I think, while I think it's a reasonable point to raise, you know, in terms of something that comes into the mix of thinking about these things, I think we have to guard against what is a very targeted amendment becoming the wrong platform for expansive commentary about economic compulsion and its relevance and when you factor it in or not. So the more I've thought about it since Sue made her comments, the more I think her suggestion is not only elegant but important in terms of saying, can we express an objective and is it more, you said flexibility, but I think of it almost more as liquidity versus expectation of what's going to happen. Because to me, it's, you know, tip my hand, it's more about the former, the liquidity, than it is predictions of what's going to happen. Because to me, the intent, the expectation about what you're going to do is something that management can discuss in its operating review, rather than getting it baked in different places to the class, in this case to classification. While I think that some field testing is useful as suggested in paragraph 41, let's not go overboard or signal that we're going to have lots and lots of examples added to this. This is supposed to be a targeted amendment of existing guidance. It's to me more just stress testing some of this, and I'll put a flag up on paragraph 32, which you also capture in paragraph 41B. I find it very hard to see. This seem to be arguments about I assess existing rights based on my probability of what's going to happen, and I think that's another reason why I wouldn't be going down the in Sue's two routes, the expected to happen route. I would be thinking more about the liquidity and rights. I don't want to build up a case against here are all the reasons why economic compulsion should factor in. Let's just not get tempted to be drawn into a debate on this platform about a very significant issue.
Clarify one thing, April. I'm just looking at this list in paragraph 41 again, 41C, this covenants are only required to be tested after the end of the reporting period. Is somebody raising the point that, say that I've got covenants which formally are only tested on particular dates, which I think is often the case, but I know as at the reporting date I'm in breach of that covenant, but I don't actually have to test it as at the reporting date, but maybe it needs to be tested 30 days later. How does that read into it? Because that's actually an interesting question.
And I think the point that came up is that some people think that if you've got a covenant that's only tested after the end of the reporting period, you don't actually have a covenant at all, because the covenant doesn't apply as at the reporting date. And other people think that actually, because the covenant will only be tested as at another date, as at the reporting date, it's an ironclad compliance with the covenant. I think my sense is that the amendment that we're proposing for IS1 is that the fact that the covenant is only tested at another time has no effect really on it being a covenant. So you would assess it in the same way as you would with any other covenant. Are you in compliance at the end of the reporting period or not?
That was what I was hoping the answer was.
But this point has been specifically raised, so I think it's worth bringing it back to the board to just say, this is what we think happens. Do you think so? I don't necessarily think that testing against these examples will change the board proposal.
No, I don't think so, but I think it might help us make sure we've got a logic in what we've done, and it might help us better articulate it so people understand how to think about the.
And it also means that you'll be clear about the impact before we.
Thank you.
All right.
Right, so if we can now look at question two, which is about linking settlement with the outflow of resources from the entity, and we propose doing that by adding, by the transfer to the counterparty of cash, equity instruments, other assets or services, to paragraph 69. Now, there is general wide support for this proposal. People thought that it was helpful and that it would clarify settlement, but one respondent suggested that the counterparty should be extended to include parties authorized by a counterparty to include circumstances when a debt is factored. A number of respondents, however, raised concern about including equity as a means of settlement. They asked how it would be affected by the requirements of 69D, that settlement is at the option of the counterparty, does not affect classification. Also about how issuing equity affects the entity's liquidity, and how extinguishment in the proposals differs from the use of extinguishment in IFRS 9. The staff also received in the comment letters and through outreach a number of examples which involve equity instruments, and we intend bringing this topic back to the board. We think this is something which the board does need to re-deliberate. Have you any other questions on question two and the request reviews, the responses?
I think there's going to be some interesting questions with these instruments that can be settled in equity. Personally, I don't think we should get over excited or over concerned about consistencies between what extinguishment means in IFRS 9 and what the conceptual framework definition is and things like that, particularly because of the scope of this project. But where I think the questions do get interesting, and again, if we could think about this when the papers are drafted, is what is it that we care about when we're looking at this liability classification? Because if something is, do I care about the fact that I have an instrument which has got a 5-year life, but it could be settled tomorrow for a variable number of shares? Does the fact that I have to deliver shares, which is a liability, but does it matter? Because is the focus liquidity or the length of the life of this instrument? Again, I think it ties back into what is it we're shooting for and what's the information we think we're getting from this current, non-current distinction. And I think we'll need to understand that to be able to answer some of these questions on convertible instruments. Because if I care about the fact that it's going to go away in a year, even if it's delivered in shares, or do I care about the fact that if I have to pay it in cash, it's a 5-year instrument, so my cash obligation's only in 5 years. What is it that I'm shooting for?
Jungwoo?
Thank you. There are many good discussions on the comments from our side. Is there any possible to think about their new conceptual framework? There are some kind of definition on liability, so some kind of a practical ability to avoid transfer. So I'm saying, maybe in the case of equity, that equity swap, it's already that if there is some kind of possibility, then that liability, regardless current or non-current, that does not meet, they may not satisfy liability.
Now, I think, Peter, I'm just looking at Peter, because I think we did have a brief discussion, Peter and Joan and I, about the conceptual framework and the work that was being done on definition of liability and how that would affect this, if any. And I think we came to the conclusion that this was consistent with the conceptual framework and that there wasn't going to be anything that would change this. Is that right, Peter?
I think that's right, but I think it's not so much about the definition. I think it really goes back to Sue's question of what the objective is, and is it about whether there's going to be an outflow of cash and when, or is it going to be about when the instrument expires?
Yeah. Is it about maturity or cash liquidity? I don't know the answer.
Any other comments, questions?
No?
Okay.
Question three in the request reviews deals with we proposed retrospective application, and most respondents agree with the proposal, but a number disagree with some of the discussion that we put into the basis. In the basis for conclusion, we discussed whether a change in classification as a result of the proposals would constitute a change in accounting policy or a change in estimate. Many respondents think this is unnecessary because paragraphs 41 and 46 in IS1 specifically require that comparatives are restated on a change of presentation. And we agree with that view, and in due course we'll propose deleting those discussions as part of your redeliberations. Have you any other questions on the third question on transition arrangements?
That is not the case.
No. And then finally, just for completeness, the paper does refer to the US project on the classification of borrowings. This is a project where the two staffs have been speaking quite frequently. I believe they intend to issue an exposure draft early next year, and that exposure draft will bring US GAAP much closer to IFRS when it comes to classification of debt. I think the current topic 470, which deals with debt, FAS 6, is going to be streamlined, and they will, in effect, take in paragraphs 69C and 69D to deal with that. The most significant difference is that they are going to have an exemption, so that if you have a waiver of a debt after the end of the reporting period, you take that, that will affect your classification. Whereas we don't have that waiver.
So it's a waiver of covenant.
Waiver of covenant.
Yeah.
And they've always had that. From, you know,
yeah.
Back
so they're retaining that from, I think it was FAS 6.
April, I was just going to make a suggestion that one of the audiences that you might to stress test this with are the rating agencies.
Right.
And the reason is from my own past experience, in terms of users or investors who actually hone in on this issue, they actually look for this disclosure in their analysis in coming up with their evaluation of a company's financial flexibility, its liquidity. I know one rating agency actually has a research product that includes discussion of this exact point. So they're very familiar with these issues. They spend a lot of time reading the legal documents. So getting their reaction to this is important. And they've always known about this provision in FAS 6 as well. And sometimes they put or assign very little weight to the existence of that, notwithstanding, because once a company is actually in the process of asking for the waiver, They're usually on the ropes, right? They have problems. So while it might give them a financial reporting benefit, the reality is they got issues.
I'm a little surprised, but what you said about the waiver that the FASB is taking into account out of the balance sheet date a waiver which was granted subsequent to the balance sheet date, as you said, because it seemed to me that we had a converged standard on post-balance sheet transactions and events, that we had a similar view of what is to be recorded as of the balance sheet date and what is a subsequent event. And the waiver is a non-adjusting event. So if they go towards allowing a special treatment for such waiver, is it in contradiction to the fundamental distinction between adjusting and non-adjusting event? Or is it an exception? Is it an exception? Or?
I think it must always have been a contradiction, because I believe this exemption dates back to the beginning of FAS 6. It's not a new exemption. It's retaining existing guidance.
FAS 6 probably came out 1975, so it's been around at least 40 years, and I don't
But we are not converged. We were not converged already.
Be thus unconverged.
Well, no, we not change.
Gary.
On
that one.
April, on the FAS 6 question, do you know, and I don't recall, fortunately I never had to get one of these things, and people were like, if you get a waiver, do they have to disclose you were in compliance and got the waiver to sort of pretend you're in compliance? Because to me that would be a material disclosure that you did it, you got a subsequent waiver of a defect, you know, after the fact. But if that's, I mean, not necessarily relevant for us, I'm assuming we're not going to move off where we are, and nor am I suggesting we should. But it does bear the question, if you're, how important is convergence? If they're assuming they're going to stay there, you know, if we got it, if we went where they were and said, but if you get a waiver that cures it, it must be disclosed. Does that address some of the concerns here about only?
I don't think our intention is to converge on.
Yeah. I don't think we should actually.
Six.
I don't.
I think it's very encouraging that they are converging on us, or moving to converge on us. On the disclosure point, I do have a copy of FAS 6, and I can look it up.
I can look it up.
I'm
too.
Not
I
familiar enough
offhand.
With the standard to know whether it's covered by.
I think actually think we should stay where we are. That either in compliance or not, you know, with the balance sheet date, and not have a subsequent cure. You can always disclose at a subsequent cure and say in my next term report this liability will be classified as long term or something. It doesn't stop you from doing that.
Okay.
Okay, so I think the question for the board on page 20 is, do you agree with the recommendation to provide further analysis of the topics raised in paragraphs 81 and 82 before we finalize the proposal?
Yes. I think we do.
Yes.
And
you've given me the other matters that you think require further analysis before the proposals. Are there any things you'd like to add to that?
Do you have any sense of your timeline on this?
Current or non-current?
Probably current.
Yeah, okay.
I think we'll bring something back to the board next year.
Well, you know it'll be next year. I mean, could you be a little bit more informative? Are you talking January, talking July? What are you thinking?
Hopefully something in Q1.
Okay, that's good. Okay.
As long as you don't ask for a waiver, okay? All right, thanks.
Hopefully.
April. Then we go to Takashi and the measurement of long-term interest.
Okay, so the next issue we'd like to discuss is one that the Interpretations Committee discussed at a few of its meetings, but on which it did not reach a consensus. It thought before possibly pursuing an agenda decision, it would be better to consult the ISB about its views on this issue. It thought such views would help the Interpretations Committee to decide what further work, if any, it should undertake. So the issue relates to measurement of long-term interest that form part of the net investment in associates, and in particular relating to impairment and whether such long-term interest should be tested for impairment by applying IAS 28, IFRS 9, or a combination of both. The submitter of the issue presented four views, which is summarized in paragraph 13 of the paper. And when the Interpretations Committee initially discussed this issue in September, there was a fair amount of support for view D, under which only IAS 28 is applied to the long-term interest with respect to the impairment, and IFRS 9 is applicable other than the impairment. And in reaching this conclusion, the Interpretations Committee noted that it would be counterintuitive to apply two different impairment testing to the same financial instruments. It also thought that in determining in which of the two impairment testing to apply, the more specific requirements should take precedence. However, it also noted that one could interpret IFRS 9 to mean that entities should apply the entire requirements of IFRS 9 to the long-term interest, including the impairment. Therefore, they thought some kind of clarification would be required. And after the meeting in September, they thought that a clarification was required. And they also thought such a clarification should address the interaction issue that would arise under that view, i.e. the recognition of interest income. So after the meeting in September, we analyzed the issue further with the focus on this interaction issue. But we found it very difficult to find a reconciliation because of the difference between IS 28 and IFRS 9. And in particular, under view D, the long-term interest would not be subject to the impairment of IFRS 9, which affects the recognition of interest income. So we decided to explore another alternative, and there are two main reasons for this decision. One is that we understood the interpretations committees in September was based on the current wordings of the standards, and also such support was conditional on whether an interaction issue would work. The other reason is that if an amendment were to be proposed instead of an interpretation, it does not have to be limited to interpreting what the current word said, especially if it is not consistent with the ISB's expectations of the applicability of IFRS 9 exclusion. So the considerations we gave in exploring another alternative are summarized in paragraph 33 of the paper. And with these considerations, we develop an alternative view under which the entire requirements of IFRS 9 would be applicable to the long-term interest. And the long-term interest, as part of the net investment, continued to be subject to loss allocation and impairment under IAS 28. The Interpretations Committee's reaction to this new proposal was mixed. While nearly half of the members supported the alternative view, some continued to support view D. And those in favor of the alternative view said that the long-term interest meets the definition of a financial instrument, and therefore it should not be excluded from IFRS 9 in any respect. They also noted that interest income would be recognized in accordance with IFRS 9. On the other hand, those who supported view D said that the long-term interest is in substance an extension of the entity's investment in associates, and therefore should be accounted for as if it is equity. They also said that view D would be more practical because of only one impairment testing. And other comments we heard include whichever view is taken, more useful information would be fair value of the long-term interest. So to sum up, the Interpretations Committee did not reach a consensus on which view to pursue as an amendment. Consequently, it considered pursuing an agenda decision that would rule out some of the views that it thought would not be appropriate. However, it thought before going down that road, it would be better to ask the ISB on its views. Now, as an overall direction of the project, we see two options. The ISB could ask the Interpretations Committee to pursue an agenda decision, which would rule out only some views, but leave open the decision on the applicability of IFRS 9 impairment to the long-term interest. This would be the case if, for example, the ISB thinks that the issue should be considered as part of the research project. On the other hand, the ISB could ask the Interpretations Committee to develop a narrow scope amendment in line with the ISB's expectation of the applicability of IFRS 9 impairment to the long-term interest. In our view, this issue is rather urgent, so we think it should be clarified before IFRS 9 becomes effective, and a narrow scope amendment would be more suitable than the research project. The content of a narrow scope amendment would depend on the ISB's expectation of the applicability of the scope exception of IFRS 9, but we think that the alternative view is better than view D, mainly because we can keep the IFRS 9 requirements intact, and the interaction under the alternative view would work better than the one under view D. Consequently, if the ISB understands the scope exception in IFRS 9 to mean that the long-term interest is subject to the entire requirements of IFRS 9, including the impairment, we recommended that the ISB should ask the Interpretations Committee to develop narrow scope amendment to IS 28 in line with the alternative view. So the first question is, do you have any questions about the issue or the Interpretations Committee's discussions?
If I can just say, when we've talked about a potential narrow scope amendment, we are only thinking about a potential amendment to IS 28. We think whichever direction you might send us in, that it could be achieved within IS 28 without needing to do anything with IFRS 9 itself.
Amaro.
Thanks. I think it's an excellent paper. Thank you. It was, although the issue is not very simple, you brought a very good summary for us. I do agree with you. This is an urgent issue. I do not think we should transfer this to a research project because of the complexity of the issue and the possibility that I do foresee in resolving it through a narrow scope. And before IFRS 9 becomes effective, I think it's much appropriate. The proposition you have on doing that in IS 28, I do prefer as well, not to change in any aspect IFRS 9. I think it's important for us not to keep changing standards before they become effective. I think this is much more appropriate to a post-implementation review if necessary. It's not in this case, I'm just mentioning in general. As for the alternatives or how to proceed, I do prefer the alternative view that was developed by the staff. I do see a clearer and simple, actually, application of IFRS 9 to the long-term commitments. And although having to pass through eventually two impairment tests, I think is the best and way to go ahead.
So,
thank you for the paper. I think it's an interesting issue, and one I think that I certainly knew in the past already existed, this question of the interaction of the impairment requirements in the FI world with IAS 28, but because we've changed to an expected loss model, it's made the interaction a more acute question, but it's not a new question. Certainly, I think one of the benchmark questions for the Interpretations Committee was whether or not the Board intended the impairment requirements in IFRS 9 to apply to these types of interests. And I certainly don't recall us ever explicitly deciding they shouldn't apply. And certainly personally, given that the interests that we're talking about here would tend to be long-term and potentially subordinated and sort of equity-like in their nature, they could be quite high-risk instruments. And I think that investors would be better served by having the same model and a forward-looking expected loss model applied to those types of instruments, because we're not just talking about, specifically it says we're not talking about things like trade receivables. It's the stuff that's more complicated that could be in the scope of this. So I think that the alternative is a better way of approaching it, and I think it would be good to clarify it for people. I do have some empathy in terms of, although conceptually I can think about it making sense to have an impairment model that's applied to an individual instrument with all the interest revenue recognition and everything that goes with that in IFRS 9, and then a second step of looking at impairment on a collective basis for the equity investment as a whole. I can see why that to me makes sense, but I can also see that preparers think that it's burdensome, which is some of the reaction I think we were getting from the Interpretations Committee. So while I think it's important that we move forward and be clear that yes, IFRS 9 is meant to be applied in these situations, I think we should have in mind as we're thinking about IAS 28, this is another aspect of potential simplification, because it's just showing how complicated the accounting is in IAS 28 for these instruments.
So your point about IFRS 9 and the expected loss model, that's why you'd rule out view C, because in the paper view C is not really discussed at all, which is just use IAS 28.
I think that there's no way IFRS 9 says that. All that IFRS 9 says in its scope section, I think the intent of IFRS 9, as it was for IAS 39, is to basically say, if you've got an equity investment that's equity accounted for, of course you shouldn't be applying the FI literature to it. I think that's all the scope section means. So for me, all the other accounting aspects of anything other than the equity accounting for the equity instruments should be in 9. So that would capture the long-term interest, including the impairment accounting, the revenue recognition, everything else, because they're not equity accounted. Where you've then got this tricky interaction is that 28 then goes on and does loss allocations and impairment tests and everything for the equity as a whole, but I think that's after you've applied IFRS 9 to the, these long-term debt type instruments.
Daryl.
So I actually don't agree with the alternative view that, that's proposed, and I think it's because I have a similar view to the application of paragraph 38 of IS 28 to what I think a lot of the dissenters, if you like, on the Interpretations Committee view it as. To my mind, what paragraph 38 is trying to say, and Sue, you sort of used the term a little bit when you were talking about it, is that the nature of the investment, this additional investment that you've made in the associate, is very similar to, is akin to, an equity type investment. Mm. And I agree that creates an additional complexity, but it means that essentially what you've done is you've got an additional equity amount that is backing the initial equity amount that you've invested. We bring it into that equity thought process, and IFRS 9, I don't think its impairment section is designed to capture the equity nature. So I start by saying, if I look at 38, I think it's trying to say that this is part of the equity. No matter what label you've put on it, it acts like an equity instrument. And therefore, IFRS 9 type impairment is not necessarily applicable. What you're looking at is more the type of impairment that you would apply if you were looking at an equity instrument measured not if you're looking at an equity instrument measured not at fair value. Now, we don't really have an equity an impairment model for that, but I don't think the IFRS 9 impairment model is designed for that. To Ian's point, I'd actually sort of initially reading this fallen more into the VC approach, in that I think that the paragraph 38 is actually already making a classification decision. Mm. So it's not just making an impairment decision, I think it's also determining that the classification is more in the nature of equity than the nature of a loan.
Can I just respond to that, Daryl, because I strongly disagree with you, much as I love you, but because I think that what IFRS 9 does is it sets the boundaries for what it thinks an impairment model can be applied to. So one of the things that comes from classification and measurement in IFRS 9 is setting the boundaries of what can be subject to amortized cost accounting. So if this debt investment has got through the solely payments of principal and interest test, and therefore is subject to impairment accounting in 9, 9's already said this is the type of instrument we think impairment accounting can be applied to. I'm with you if it's such a strange instrument that impairment accounting doesn't make sense, but I'd be relying on IFRS 9 to provide my filter for that, because if it really has got so many bells and whistles, it's not going to meet solely payments of principal and interest, in which case it's going to be measured at fair value through P&L anyway, and this whole impairment question in 28 would go away.
I
don't think we should be having another filter of, 9 says it should be subject to impairment, but actually I feel slightly different about this, so I'll use a different filter.
I don't think we need another filter. What I think 28 is essentially saying is that these things are different to the normal. And they're different to the normal because 28 says this is actually not... It might be labelled as a loan agreement. It might look like it has loan agreement type things. But from the perspective of 28 is saying, actually, this is a completely different instrument because it is part of my investment into the underlying entity.
But
the fact that I've labelled it a loan doesn't change the fact that it is essentially equity. And then I agree with you that if this instrument were to get into 9, then it may well be subject to impairment. It might well tick the box for impairment. But I think 38 means that it doesn't even get into 9 in the first place. And some of the bits in brackets in 38 where it describes where it describes the type of loan that it's thinking about. It's thinking about loans without fixed repayment terms, possibly without interest, et cetera, et cetera. So I just feel that maybe it's that the test in 38 is not as clear as it could be, and sometimes the test in 38 is bringing in things it shouldn't. But my way of thinking about that test in paragraph 38 is I'm looking for stuff that is investment just mislabeled.
Philippe?
Two basic questions.
one and be follow up of what Darrell said. Are all loans to associates all the same, always the same? I.e., are they all part of the investment, or are there situations where they are not meant to be part of the investment and be real loans? So is there always one single answer to that question? I'm not sure that we can make put all loans to associates in the same category and say they are always part of the investment, and depends on the conditions, maybe.
Can I answer that with reading what 38 says? 38 says, joint venture determined using the together with any long-term interest that in substance form part of the entity's net investment.
That's
so those on normal commercial conditions, I don't think in substance forms part.
So maybe we have to do some work on this in substance, and depending on how you analyze it, maybe say you apply S9 or you apply S28, depending on the answer to that question. So, second question is, if we follow the staff recommendations, how can we make sure we avoid double counting of the losses? First, through the impairment, and second, by the picking up of the losses of the associate. Isn't there a risk of double counting? I take it twice. I take it
part
of my loan, and also I book my share of losses, because most of the time when you have an impairment, expected loss impairment, is because the associate is making losses. If it is profitable, you are probably not going to have an impairment issue. So we have two situations here. You have the loan where you do the impairment, expected loss, and then you have your share of the losses. It seems to me that if you impair your loan based on the expected loss model, you have to assume that this loan will not have to be repaid by the associate. It will turn up to be an accounting profit in the associate's books. So maybe that should be taken into account in measuring the losses to be picked up, so that you have a kind of a symmetric, if I could say, accounting.
I would have thought, because of the interaction actually and because of the expected loss model, we'd probably reduce the number of circumstances where you'd get 28 impairment.
Yes. Or even 28 allocation of loss to the loan, because with the expected loss model, it's more likely you'll get impairment under IFRS 9 earlier.
Yes.
And as you say, you could quite easily be in a situation where the associate is still profitable or marginally profitable, but you still record an impairment.
Simple fact pattern. The associate is break-even this year, but I know based on budgets and forecasts it will be in severe losses next year and the year after. Would that trigger an impairment under the expected loss model? Maybe. So I would book this year, in my books, my expected losses on the loan. And next year, I would have to pick up my share of the losses in the books of the associate. Is not there some form of accumulation of twice the same thing? Or
I was also a little bit intrigued about fair value to profit and loss if it didn't meet the criteria in 9. How would that all fit in with equity accounting?
But that's the case today. That's not IFRS 9, right?
That's right. And that raises the question about how do you apply equity accounting and those provisions within IAS 28 to those sorts of instruments. IAS 28 doesn't really distinguish between these different types of instrument. It says, you do the loss allocation and you test for impairment as a whole under IAS 28. It raises, in my mind, it raises the question about the validity of including these financial assets which are not investment in ordinary shares as part of the equity investment, but that really is a question for the equity accounting project, not something I think for this particular issue that we're looking at.
Can I jump in on that? Because I think it addresses a point that Darrell has raised. What you've just said and what Darrell is saying is obviously, I think, the critical point in deciding whether or not you go with the staff's alternative view or you go with some other view here. What Darrell is asserting is that paragraph 38 essentially allows you to conclude that an instrument that otherwise purports to be a debt instrument, a fixed income instrument, or a financial asset with a maturity and interest rate, et cetera, you conclude that it's part of the quote-unquote net investment. And that's what paragraph 38 says. It says basically that for example, an item for which settlement is neither planned nor likely to occur in the foreseeable future is in substance an extension of the entity's investment. Well, that puts you now into the realm of management's intent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It's basically overriding the substance of the instrument. I made an equity investment and I also lent this entity money. Just because, okay, I don't plan, okay, to essentially, you know, redeem it or change any of its terms in the near future, extend it, etc., doesn't change the nature of what I have there. Okay, so this literature here, in my opinion, is flawed. Okay, but we have to live with it, all right, for the time being. So I think we're talking about making a judgment, and if in fact this is something that falls within the scope of IFRS 9, if you make that judgment, then I think the staff's view is correct. But you can't say that something that is in fact a debt instrument, I'm going to say, it's not really, because, you know, under this language here, I don't plan, or it's not likely in the near future to extend, you know, this instrument. You can't just make up, you know, some assumptions and decide now it's part of the net investment. Either it is or it isn't.
But I think we call that substance over form, and we do it often. We often say, look to the underlying substance of the nature, and this is items. Firstly, we have to say it's in substance and they're part of the net investment, and then we go further to say, okay, I agree with you, the planned is in there, nor likely. So you're looking at what the expected outcome is. So I'm not sure. I think what you're essentially saying is that if something has the word loan written on it, you will treat it as a loan irrespective of what substance.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
SPPI.
No,
I'm actually. And if it goes through SPPI.
Yeah, look at the terms of the instrument. And in fact, this is an instrument where I expect to be repaid. I've set a maturity date. I have an interest rate, either implied or explicit. Okay.
Who says that the maturity date has to be in there?
Well, there has to be solely payments of principal and interest to be accounted for under impairment in 9, which is
to get an impairment test. But if you're saying it fits under 9, then essentially if it fails the SPPI test, it goes to fair value profit and loss, which I still don't think is consistent with what you're doing with the rest of your equity investment. So if you conclude that this is essentially part of the equity investment, but it fails the SPPI test, I'm still not measuring it as part of that. And I think it's that disconnect that I'm battling with.
So what are you going to do with interest revenue on these instruments that you've taken out of 9?
Yeah. Well, I actually don't even know if it should be treated as interest revenue. If it's part of the net investment, it's part of my investment in the underlying.
So you're going to equity account it?
But I guess the key point here is you can't override the substance of what the actual instrument is. That's my point.
You can't override the substance, but you can override the form.
But this language would in theory allow you to do that, okay? And I think that's just simply bad accounting, okay? So if in fact you conclude that in substance what you have is a loan, then I think the staff's recommendation is sound.
And if you in substance have a loan, then you kicked out of 38.
Yes. But I think the point that you were making earlier, I think in disagreeing with Sue is incorrect. I think Sue is right when in fact the substance is a loan.
That's just because you're sitting next to her.
Unfortunately, this language here, okay, allows you to do this bad accounting, in my opinion. All right. So if in fact you conclude your substance is in fact an equity instrument, then you'd be allowed to, I think, apply the guidance of 28. That's my reading of it. You disagree, Mary?
Not my turn.
Thank you. That's correct. Maybe Darren raised a very interesting point, but let's assume that this is we are using their classification measurement requirements in IFRS 9. Let's assume that for the time being. Because the interpretation committee reviewed the view A, B, C, D. Now, view C might be related to the Darren's, but most of the interpretation committee members agreed with the view B, A, B, or D might be a more plausible alternative rather than view C. So you might assume this is an IFRS 9 classification can be applied this long-term interest. Based on that assumption, I would like to suggest we should think about another alternative to this, your alternative. That is a kind of a view A. So it seems to me, you know, IFRS 9 impairment test might be enough to provide very relevant information on this kind of impairment loss without having to make a double test of the one, the IFRS 9 impairment test, another one is the IS-20A impairment test, because it seems to me expected loss model might provide a big amount of impairment loss in the first step, and in the second step, even though you apply the IS-20A, in that case, there's not a pure impairment test. It's kind of an allocation of another impairment losses, like a general operating losses. So it seems to me these two steps are in nature quite different from the pure impairment loss, just on one single and a long-term interest. Another one is a kind of big unit of account. That's a kind of a composition of many, many things. So it's a kind of a allocation, another an allocation rather than the impairment lost. So based on these two points, you know, maybe rather giving a hardship to preparers to do a double test on this long-term interest, I guess one single impairment test might be enough, not giving a hardship. And also we can have a quite relevant information on this issue, and we can see, present all the effects based on the allocation of impairment losses on this bigger unit of account. So these are things that might give a more good news to preparers rather than asking double tests.
Steve.
So I agree with the staff recommendation. I agree with Sue, disagree with Chungwu, and disagree with Daryl. It seems to me that we shouldn't do a fundamental reconsideration of this. We've got to keep it narrow. I don't think the reference to substance over form in paragraph 38 refers to the classification of the interest, because it says you apply equity accounting to the equity interest, not to these other interests. So there's no question, I don't think, of saying, well, in substance, this debt instrument is an equity instrument, and let's apply equity accounting. So we shouldn't go there. Therefore, you apply 9 to the debt interest. I think you should apply it in full. Then the substance over form comes in terms of, well, what is your bigger long-term interest in the investment? And then apply the IS-28 impairment test to that. And I think it works fine to apply that to the carrying value of your equity interest, which is equity accounting, and the carrying value of the debt interest, which is IFRS 9 accounting, add them together and apply the IS-28 impairment test, which is your recommendation. I think that works fine.
Mary.
I think we have, the staff has brought to us an issue that they consider pressing, which is resolving before the effective date of IFRS 9 whether or not the impairment requirements of that standard apply to these interests. I think our discussion has identified a number of bad fits between some changes made in the past and IS-28 in particular. At this time, I'd say if the urgent question is, do you apply IFRS 9 or no, let's guard against scope creep in terms of providing guidance about when something is or is not, what's the phrase?
Solid payments of principal and interest.
No, I'm not going to quote IFRS 9, Sue. whether or not it's part of the long-term investment. And these other issues, let's just focus on yes or no. I hesitate a bit to say we will tell the interpretation committee what to think and ask them to develop an interpretation. I think you've come back to us having got to this logjam at the interpretation committee. I think I'd join Steve, in terms of taking the board's initial feedback to the interpretation committee being, when you put together all the pieces, it seems to signal to me that the change made to IS 28 was identifying additional investments as part of the loss absorption capacity. It wasn't putting the whole instrument in IS 28 accounting, so it would seem like the financial instrument standard applies for the general accounting for that investment. And if you go back to the interpretation committee and say majority of the board, if it is indeed a majority, thought X, that the change made was just to put those other items in the loss absorption calculation, then that would seem to suggest a staff, the staff alternative approach, rather than view D. With that, can the interpretation committee develop guidance, conclusion, etc.? If they can't, then I don't know that we force it down their throats. Either we have to decide to do it, or accept that there will be, not happily, diversity in terms of whether people are saying this whole thing is in IS 28, but then I think it's making the point that it's the whole thing is in 28, and you're not doing interest accrual, etc., because you're taking it out so you don't even get to the SPPI test. Right now at this stage, I don't like it, but I think if somebody has the really inconsistent logic of saying, I'm taking it all out of the financial instrument standard because I'm a UC person, but then I'm going to do IS39/IFRS9 type interest accrual, that doesn't hang together, and that's one observation. The reason I'm pushing for being contained about what we do next and targeted rather, is looking at the research agenda which we're discussing this afternoon. We do have, I'll call it a medium-term project on IS 28, and I think if we think we need to solve all these other issues with IS 28, is the whole thing in there? How do you account for these, drawn up as debt but actually considered part of the long-term investment, etc.? We should kick that into the medium-term, how do you apply IS 28 project? That's not the long-term research project. So
So you agree with the staff recommendation?
I agree with the staff recommendation, but not tell the interpretation committee thou shalt develop something that says this. I say, here's the feedback from the board. With that feedback, do you think you can do it? If they say, if they're still divided,
then either
we decide to do it, or we just accept that there's either going to be, I think, a VC. Or
hopefully not.
But I think the staff have done what the committee said. We want to understand from the board what your thoughts were in terms of does 9 apply and how does this interaction work.
And we'll listen.
Yes. They've asked for it.
Doug?
Thank you. I strongly agree with Darrell. And I disagree with what the Pat said, and paragraph IS 28, paragraph 38 is not flawed at all, because actually, as you read, paragraph 38 says it's a very narrow issue, and it says the item for which settlement is neither planned nor likely to occur the foreseeable future, and in substance, it is an investment. And also said this is the case that you do not have a collateral, or this is not the case of trade receivable.
So accounting by intent, essentially. Even though it has a maturity date, you can disregard the maturity date because it's not due anytime soon.
No, I'm going to call it equity.
Let
me explain. Actually, there are many cases when you have a business in the mining industry with the developing countries. So there are often the case you cannot invest more, you cannot put in equity more than a certain limit. In that case, you have to support that entity. And of course, to some extent, it's an entity's intent, but there is often the case you end up putting some money without any settlement in the future. And that's also, this paragraph 38 refers to preference shares as well. So therefore, in intent of IS 28, paragraph 38 is very clear. This is a substantial equivalent to the equity investment. And the other evidence that this is clear is if you go to the IS 21, paragraph 15, paragraph 15 of IS 21 uses the same word, which says that an item for which settlement is neither planned or likely to occur in the foreseeable future is, in substance, a part of the entity's net investment. And then IS 21 says, in that case, the foreign currency change should go to OCI rather than profit or loss. So actually, interaction with the IS 21 and the IS 28, paragraph 38 is very clear. It is very narrow population of the transaction, which is in substance equity. And then if that is the case, what we can do? And I strongly agree with that interpretation's concern that we should do something before the effective date of IFRS 9. We have got to do something. So therefore, I disagree to put it into the research. So then what we can do? Probably we can issue some kind of interpretation to explain that the paragraph 38 of IS 28 is very narrow scope one, and this is quite a limited one. And if we could provide such kind of interpretation, in a timely basis, I think we can avoid this without changing IS 28. I strongly disagree with changing IS 28 anymore, because it causes lots of unintended consequences. As long as we change the standard, we may end up, another new issues, especially the situation like Philip pointed out. So I strongly agree with Darrell, and I would rather suggest not to make an amendment and not to leave it to research, but to make an interpretation about IS 28, paragraph 38.
May I ask a question of Tuck? In your view, for the items that are within paragraph 38, and so therefore part of the long-term investment, which of the views in this paper do you believe apply? Okay, I just
want to recognize interest as a revenue rather than interest. It's an equity, like a dividend.
So instead of recognizing interest income, you would recognize income on this long-term investment as part of applying the equity method.
Yeah, not exactly equity method, but maybe kind of revenue type interest.
That's changing 28.
I think that's a problem.
That's not
28. Yeah. Let's see if we can agree with the staff recommendation.
2, 3, 4, 6, 7.
7 out of 13. Well,
it's a majority.
I would say we will report back the discussion, the results of the discussion. So it wouldn't just be the final vote that we'd be reporting back. We'd report back the richness of the discussion.
I could agree, subject to answering my question about the double count.
Just one more comment. But if you go down that path to the alternative view or view B, then in that case we have to change the IS 21 as well. Otherwise, it's very inconsistent. So in many cases, equity accounting is used to the mining business, and the impact is very huge in the mining business. And in the mining business, as I described, they are all developing countries, and the interest rate is a very, very important part of their investment. And if you neglect the foreign exchange part and recognizing something old day one impairment means nothing at all. So it's very old. So if you go down the path to the view B type of accounting, or your alternative view, in that case, you definitely have to address the IS 21, paragraph 15. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense.
We're certainly aware of the IS 21.
Yeah, I know that. I read, yeah.
Yes. I mean, we don't see it as being in conflict, yeah, or a problem, but we'll make sure we incorporate that into our paper, right, just to be sure of that.
If you're feeding back to the Interpretations Committee, should you perhaps identify whether the six have the same view or they have diverse views?
I'm not sure how helpful it's going to be to go back to the committee and say, you had a diverse range of views and so does the board.
Yeah, because it is a rather narrow majority. I mean, I'm happy to say that I basically go along with the text point of view. Yeah, and I think that's the case for all those who have not supported.
Yeah.
So I don't understand.
Where does that leave us?
So that means changing 28 so that these debt instruments
are equity accounted. Even though they have no share of profit.
No, I think the starting point is simply to say that we don't think that IFRS 9 increases the value of understanding what's happening.
Because IFRS 9, paragraph 2.1 says that the scope issue, those interest in the subsidiary, associates, and the joint ventures are accounting for IFRS 10 and IAS 28. So then that means, so it's out of the IFRS 9. And that's it.
Not the debt instruments, though.
No.
Not the debt. Yeah, but we don't have to, decide whether it's an equity or debt instrument now. But only we have to do is it's out of the scope of IFRS 9.
Steve said, but not the debt instruments. And I think you would say if the instrument issued is in the form of a debt instrument, notionally a 5% bond, but you consider that bond to be part of the net investment. I think you would say that is outside the scope entirely of IFRS 9.
Exactly.
But it's not in the scope of 28.
No. In the scope
it's
of
just now in limbo.
It's not in the scope of 28, so I would agree that. But it's not the scope of IFRS 9. So you can account.
So where is it?
In which scope is it then?
I fundamentally disagree with that. I'm very
fundamentally but obviously, it says it's out of the scope of IFRS 9.
It doesn't. That's equity investments that are equity accounted for in the scope of IAS 28.
I take your point. Yes. IAS 28, it should be equity accounting. The question is whether or not we apply equity accounting in the long-term loans. That's a questionable point.
I'm not sure how you can equity account something that's entitled to a...
Having said that, it is quite obvious that the situation is quite narrow, and as you can see, IS 21 and IS 28, it is an extension of equity investment.
I've got a question for Tak and Daryl and the others in that view, and I've got some sympathy for that view as well. Is the fact pattern you've got in mind where the investors are all giving loans in proportion to their shareholdings? Because it seems to me that's really the case where it's an extension.
My experience with these has been if you are not giving a loan in proportion to the others, then you tend to have commercial terms like interest and repayment dates and etc. But frequently in these cases, everybody gives a loan proportional to their underlying. In my experience, and I think these types of things are tax-driven, very often without a maturity date and very often without a predetermined interest rate. That immediately means they fail SPPI, so you actually go into, I think, fair value accounting in all likelihood.
Yeah, and I think there's a good case in that sort of fact pattern for saying that it is partly a question of form over substance, whether you give it all as shares or as loans or as some mixture of shares.
And I think tax point on a developing country, where you're not allowed to earn more than 25%.
Yeah.
But you want to put in 50% of the money, so you put half in as equity, half in as a loan. because otherwise you break the law.
But that's not going to be what people are going to take from the discussion.
Yeah.
Every time they have a long-term loan to an associate, they're going to say no more expected credit loss.
Doesn't say every time you have a
that's
law.
What the risk is, though.
But
we've
but
no
you clearly said, paragraph 38 clearly said in the case you don't have any settlement date, in substance same as the...
I think a part of the difficulty is that 38 says a loan that is collateralized is clearly not part of the net
yeah.
investment. A loan without a maturity date is clearly... is often going to be considered
yeah.
part of the net investment and then doesn't define the area in between. So I do agree with you, there's some risk with that area in between. But the reality is if you don't have those normal conditions of a loan, it does feel more like the investment than the...
Well, and that was the reason for my question, really, whether a possible way forward might be to try and pin down slightly better what the circumstances are when we think this might apply.
Interpret 38.
Interpret
well,
38.
Well, that's what
it takes. Yeah. Interpret 38 and pin down what is the situation. It's quite narrow. So in that very narrow case, then you can treat it as if it were equity.
I don't disagree with the whole notion of quote unquote pinning something down and getting to what the actual facts are. The example that you introduced, Peter, though, is not consistent with the language in 38. Okay, in 38, they're talking about an item for which settlement is neither planned nor likely to occur in the foreseeable future, but in fact is required. So that is a loan. Okay.
Yeah, but
so that's not the circumstance that Daryl is talking about.
Where do you read that it's required to be repaid?
Because it says for which settlement is neither planned nor likely to occur.
Yeah,
that's essentially implied that it's required
yeah.
there. Okay?
No. There is a loan that which you don't have any repayment
might
date.
Be, but if it's not likely that
so
too.
It's almost same as equity.
I think this discussion shows that the current version of 28 just does not mesh very easily with IFRS 9. What we need is this long-term project on 28. Personally, I feel very uncomfortable about making piecemeal changes to 28 because we've demonstrated more than once and had this conversation more than once that it's a dangerous thing to do. There are unforeseen consequences. And I just think there probably isn't a logical conclusion to this discussion because you've got
so
standards which are different.
Would be the best way forward, what IFRIC has suggested?
No, that's just going to increase diversity.
It is.
Because it's blessing diversity.
Yeah. To me, we need this long-term project on 28 sorted out, and I think we need something which more obviously matches
something
with
before
not.
The IFRS 9's effective date.
Well, you know, the proposal that we had
yeah.
was to say that you account for these instruments entirely within 9 and then do the additional steps that IAS 28 says. That doesn't change the IAS 28 accounting, which I agree with you, Hugh.
I'm just so we're in the second best world, and if we make changes, does it make things better or worse? That's my concern.
How can you apply two different standards
yeah.
to the same
yeah.
thing, one after the other?
We do already with IFRS 5.
Yeah. IFRS 5 is contentious.
It's an exception to normal rules. You don't apply twice.
Okay, who has a solution?
I don't know that it's a solution, but in terms of improving the usefulness of the feedback to the interpretation committee, maybe it's worth asking how many board members who support the staff recommendation would object if the interpretation committee came back with a draft interpretation for our approval that did not require the application of IFRS 9, because there's a difference between, you know, which of these do you prefer, and if you're feeding back to the interpretation committee, give them a sense of the difference in views, and they say we want to develop something that does not require the application of IFRS 9, I don't want them to spend two meetings doing that to come back and have it rejected as a draft interpretation. So maybe it's a question of finding out whether, based on what we know so far, that's a dead-end route. Now, for example, I supported the staff proposal. I think at this point I'm not ready to say I would vote to block a draft interpretation, but I think Sue would. So let's see if it's anything other than IFRS 9 is DOA based on the number of objections. So I think that would be useful, how to proceed information for the interpretation committee.
So So your question is that if the Interpretations Committee was to develop some interpretation that would not require the application of IFRS 9 in full to these instruments, how many...
The application of IFRS 9 impairment, at least.
Impairment, yes. Then who would object?
Who would object to issuing that draft interpretation?
One, two, three, four. And it's draft interpretations go out, or interpretations go out if no more than four board members object.
Okay. So they know they're right at the margin.
I thought it was three. No?
No.
Okay.
That's the committee? Oh, that's
it's
the committee.
Not conclusive, but it's just information for them about what risk they're taking going
through the grounds. When they come up with a solution, there may be great objections here anyway.
Yes.
And this is the ping pong game.
Who's right?
Well, we are planning, as I've written to you before, to have a joint meeting of the board with the Interpretations Committee in March.
Yes.
So,
yeah, good idea.
We need a different mechanism, probably, because it's not efficient to get it back and forth.
Yes.
So, but you would suggest you discuss it then?
Those technical.
If we were to have a technical discussion, it would obviously need to be a public discussion. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll give that some thought anyway.
Have we ever done that before?
No.
Yeah. It would be quite difficult to have 27 people discussing this.
Even though we only have four board members who really strongly disagree, I hope that others are a bit concerned about having just done an expected credit loss model that people now don't have to apply. So at a minimum, if we have to go down that dreadful route, could we try and constrain it so that it's clear that people shouldn't be just routinely applying this horrible accounting to too many things?
Very awkward signal.
One of the decisions, or one of the routes that the Interpretations Committee might decide on hearing the feedback, is not to add the issue to its agenda and to issue an agenda decision instead.
But I think that's terrible as well, because now we've had this discussion, which for many is going to bless stuff which some of us is going to think is really bad practice. So if we had to do something that's not what I want, could we not at least try and, to Peter's point, and Tack's point, put at least a few more bars about when we think people might legitimately be within the scope of paragraph 38, then at least it's not quite so problematic. Narrow it down.
That was Tack's.
Yeah, which was Tack's suggestion.
Okay.
I think that would be better than just a free-for-all.
That's the best solution going forward, given the fact that we will have a longer-term project on IAS.
That makes it clear that we're only talking special circumstances here, not routinely, that just because you're an associate, you're out of scope of 9.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
something
that
near
that would be work done by us, or?
No, by the Interpretations Committee.
So by you.
Yes.
I don't think it's difficult to make that interpretation. Of the 30,
I think that's probably the intention.
All right. Okay, thank you very much. That's a we were going to discuss another issue before the break. I think it's time for a break. Let's wait until 1:30.
We have one agenda paper. Definition of business.
After break.
Will be postponed?
Yeah, until 1:30. Let's.